listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Michael Cunningham loved fairy tales as a child. Now, I'm saying this in the presence of his father and his sister, so if I'm wrong, you can interrupt me. The Cunningham family is here. Father, sister, Esther, everybody's here. Where are they? There they are. Welcome. Delighted to have you here. Well, you know better than I do. Michael loved fairy tales as a child, and most of us also do. Once upon a time worked for him, but he was never satisfied with the typical fairy tale ending. Happy all the time? Forever? Does anyone really believe that? From early on, he wondered, when one part of the story ends, doesn't another part of the story begin? The marvelous collection, The Wild Swan and Other Tales, is Michael's exploration of that salient question. And I think you'll find that the tales he's written, which are so beautifully illustrated, enlarges rather than reduces the haunting mystery of the originals. Michael Cunningham, as many of you know, is the author of 7 novels, including A Home at the End of the World, Flesh and Blood, The Hours, which won the Pulitzer Prize, Specimen Days, a favorite of mine, and By Nightfall. And we're so pleased to welcome Michael back to his native Southern California. He used to come to this library and the Pasadena Library as a young person. And in conversation with Michael tonight is yet another award-winning author, we're so lucky in LA, who makes Los Angeles her home and whose work often dips into the deep sources of fairy tales. In her most recent story collection, The Color Master, Bender tells the story of a woman who marries an ogre and struggles with whether to stay with him after he mistakenly eats their children. I'm sure you all know people like this. Amy's other books are The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, An Invisible Sign of My Own, Willful Creatures, and The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, not to be missed, by the way. Please join me in welcoming Michael Cunningham and Amy Bender to the stage of the Los Angeles Public Library.
It occurred to me that it's not the worst thing to be able to talk about fairy tales when the real world is in such a difficult place.
Yeah. Well, of course, fairy tales are kind of about the real world.
They are, right.
But meant to horrify children.
Yeah.
Before they're ready for the real life horrors, we give them new pretend horrors. They're just precursors of what's to come.
Right, exactly. Now, you're going to read.
I am going to read.
Okay.
I am going to read. Am I still audible? I get nervous about this. Okay, great. Great. Yes, I'm going to read. And
okay.
Amy made a request.
I did.
Writers, rock stars get requests. Writers never get requests. And so, of course, because I love Amy and so admire her work, and she made a request.
Should I explain my request while you're fine?
Would you please? Yes.
Yeah. So in the book, the last story, Ever After, is, I think, a remarkable achievement of a hopeful story. And so I did say to Michael, on a day that is really a dark day for Los Angeles, it might be really nice to hear a story like that in particular.
Yes, yes. This is the only invented story in the book. The others are all based on actual fairy tales. I made this one up. It's called Ever/After. Once in time, a prince lived in a castle on a knoll under a sky brightened by the royal blue of the harbor. Arrayed along the slope that descended from castle to harbor was a town in which carpenters made widely coveted tables and chairs, and bakers baked cakes and pies that people traveled some distance to procure. Every morning, the local fishermen hauled in nets full of sparkling silver fish. Every night, the smell of grilling fish filled the air. The avenue that skirted the harbor was lit by cafes and taverns, from which music and laughter were gently wind-borne throughout the town into the forest, where hares and pheasants paused occasionally to listen. When the prince turned 18, he was married to a princess from a nearby, less prosperous kingdom, an inland kingdom built on a river centuries dry, a place where the chalky soil produced only cabbages and parsnips and other such hardy but uncompelling vegetables, where the cafes were all closed by 9 o'clock. And the local artisans produced nothing but coarse, heavy woolen blankets and jerseys, which were offered optimistically as the best defense against the icy winds that blew from the glacier on the mountaintop. The princess's hand was sought for the prince by the prince's father, the king, as protection against the day when the princess's kingdom sent its soldiers, scrawny and weak, from their meager diet, all the more dangerous for their endless feelings of deprivation, bearing bows and long swords into the verdancy and abundance of the kingdom on the harbor, and declared it rightfully theirs. The princess's father agreed, in part because he had too little confidence in his own starved and sullen army, and in part because the princess in question, the eldest of his three daughters, the one most lacking in traditional charms, had received no other offers by the age of 22, but was required by law to be married before marriage could be permitted either of her younger sisters, both of whom, it struck the king as a cruel joke, were lithe and lovely. The marriage did not go well at first. The prince recognized his duty and performed it. The princess did as well. The princess, being other than beautiful, needed no delusions about how a deal had been struck, how she had been foisted off on a husband who would, she believed, carry out the perfunctory marital duties and then set about in his true amorous vocation with chambermaids and duchesses and the occasional harlot smuggled in from town. She was, as it turned out, mistaken. Although during the wedding, which was also the occasion of their first meeting, and immediately after, he struck her as posturing and false, a prince who seemed to have been inexpertly instructed in the ways of princes. Hold your head a little higher. No, not quite that high. Speak in a commanding tone. No, that doesn't mean shout. He soon proved not to be, as she'd expected, deceitfully confident about the skills he lacked. He was handsome, far handsomer than she, but his beauty was milky and ephemeral, moist-eyed. He was one of those boys of whom, by the time he'd turned 50, others would whisper, "You wouldn't believe it. He was once such a pretty boy," in tones of scandalized satisfaction. But more unexpected, he was so nervous, so unsure that he could not imagine himself as king, that was becoming king one day was inevitable as mortality itself. All of which he confessed to her immediately on their wedding night. It did not seem to occur to him that a fear might go unspoken, that anxiety could be masked. He, for his part, was initially disappointed, but soon surprised by her as well. When she first appeared to him on their wedding day, in her bridal finery, Her bridal finery, however artful, could not disguise her heftiness. The great dome of her forehead or the stunted apostrophe of her nose. She might have been a barge, steered by her father with the steady determination of commerce along the cathedral aisle. This, then, would be the face. These would be the mannish shoulders and the breadth of hip he'd be seeing daily for the rest of his life. And yet, on their wedding night, when they were finally alone in the royal bedchamber, let's say she could not have been the virgin the tradition and propriety demanded her to be. She couldn't have invented tricks like that, untutored. Who knew how many stable boys or how many pages she had pushed down onto haystack or secluded lawn? He liked not only the fleshly revelations, he who was, in fact, as virginal as she was supposed to be, but the evidence that she had been ill-behaved. He liked as well his first sight of her nakedness. She was stocky, but firm. Her body all hillocks and white, satiny risings. On that first night, she told him, unembarrassed, what to do, and he, being inexperienced, was glad to obey. He who faced a future of issuing commands, of others looking at him questioningly, waiting for him to make the decision, every time. The king died soon after, trampled on a hunt by the very horse he considered his truest companion. The prince was, to his horror, made king 3 weeks before his 19th birthday. She fell into love with a strange sense of powerlessness, as if she and her husband had contracted the same disease at the same time. She looked forward to the mornings, seeing him groggy but sweet upon awakening. He liked to be held just for a few minutes before getting out of bed and attending to his kingly duties. She liked talking to him at night, after the duties had been dispatched, about everything, from the small particulars of the day to his love of a local poet, recently deceased, from whose work the new king could quote at length. She was surprised and oddly, if only briefly, disappointed to find that she'd been wrong about the chambermaids and harlots, that he actually intended every night to return to their bed, that he did not cease to delight in her willingness to command. Hold still, relax. Now, I know it hurts a little, but give in to it. Pain, in moderation, has its pleasures. During the months after his coronation, it was increasingly impossible for her to believe that he undervalued her intelligence. She was, in fact, intelligent. It was ever more apparent that he prized her opinions over those of his counselors, she whose only official purposes were peacekeeping and the production of heirs. By the time he turned 20, just after she'd turned 24, it was evident that they ruled together, secretly, that he, as tradition demanded, would offer as his own pronouncements every day that which they had decided together the night before when they were alone in bed. Decades passed. They had a son, a daughter, and a second son. Their lives, their reign, was not untroubled. Among their subjects, there were robbers, contract disputes, lawsuits over property lines that had been drawn a century ago. The axe maker's wife beat her husband to death with a lamb bone, and as the police took her away, proclaimed that she hadn't wanted to sully one of the axes. In the castle, a maid was impregnated by a page, and although the king and queen would not have punished her, drowned herself in a well. The cook fought continually with the housekeeper, each delivering for almost 30 years a weekly report about the excesses and callousness of the other. Among the family, the daughter, the middle child, who had not only inherited but doubled her mother's tendency to corpulence, jumped out a window at the age of 12, but it being only a second-story window, landed unharmed on a hydrangea bush, and having made the gesture once, seemed to feel no need of making it again. The second son, the youngest child, knowing he'd never be king, ran off when he turned 17, but returned less than a year later, thin and ragged, having tried to live as a bard and troubadour in a neighboring kingdom, but having found that his limited gifts attracted scant attention. He decided he could manage as a prince, composing verses and singing songs at occasional palace recitals. The oldest boy was almost suspiciously untroubled. He was hale and stalwart, confident, without an edge of arrogance. But his was not the most subtle and penetrating of minds. And it was impossible for his parents to refrain from periods of doubt about his ability to be king himself when the day arrived. Although the king and queen never ceased entirely to worry over their children, the older boy remained true and devoted and took on a more royal aspect as he entered his 20s. The younger boy married a homely but insightful princess from several kingdoms away, wrote volumes of verse for his wife, who believed him to be a genius, unheralded in his time, but sure to be vindicated by history. The daughter did not marry, though she had offers, but became an expert archer, a hunter, and a sailor, and took great joy in everything she did so well. The king and queen themselves were not untouched by sorrows or trials. In late middle age, the king believed himself to have fallen in love with an absurd but imperiously serene, lunar, and ethereally pallid duchess, and needed a fortnight to learn that she intoxicated but bored him. The queen, soon after the duchess episode, returned to her old habit of pushing pages and stable boys down onto hay bales and secluded lawns until the boy's helpless willingness, the thoughts of advancement that were audible through their lascivious moans, became more humiliating than gratifying. The king and queen returned to each other, battered, humbled, and strangely amused by their escapades. They found, to their mutual surprise, that they seemed to love each other more rather than less for having shown, rather late in the game, this capacity for their blood to rise. She said to him on occasion, "I'm turning slender and shy. I'm learning to weep discreetly when the nightingales sing." He said to her on occasion, "Straddling me won't raise you any higher. Are you sure it's worth the effort?" Which, to their shared surprise, always made them both laugh. Eventually, decades later, when the king was dying, the queen gently ushered everybody out into the corridor, closed the door to the royal bedchamber, and got into bed with her husband. She started singing to him. They laughed. He was short of breath, but he could still laugh. They asked each other, "Is this silly? Is this pretentious?" But they both knew that everything there was to say had been said already over and over across the years. And so the king believed, released, free to be silly, asked her to sing him a song from his childhood. He didn't need to be regal anymore. He didn't need to seem commanding or dignified, not with her. They were, in their way, dying together. And they both knew it. It wasn't happening only to him. So she started singing. They shared one last laugh. They agreed that the cat had a better voice than she did. Still, she sang him out of the world. When the queen was dying, years later, there were 23 people in the room, as well as 3 cats and 2 dogs. There were her children and their children's children, 3 of her maids, 2 pages, the older and the younger, long known to be lovers, their secret honored by everyone, and the cook and the housekeeper who delivered their final complaints only weeks earlier. The animals, the dogs and cats, were in bed with the queen. The people knew somehow to stand at a certain distance, except for Sophia, the oldest maid, who moistened the queen's brow with a handkerchief. The room wasn't silent or reverent. One of the babies fussed. One of the dogs snarled at one of the cats. But the queen, who was enormous by then and pale as milk, looked at all the beings surrounding her, human and animal, with a certain grave compassion, as if they were the ones who were dying. Just before she passed away, a grandchild said to another, "She's like a planet, don't you think?" The other replied, "No, she's like a sick old lady." Each felt pleased by the proof of the other's foolishness. Each boy, as their grandmother, the queen, sank away, thought of his own promising future. One, because he had a poet's eye and heart. The other, because he was unsentimental and true. Each believed, as their grandmother died, that he'd go far in the world. As it turned out, both of them were right. All the children prospered after the queen had been put to rest. Her eldest son, who had, at his mother's insistence, ruled since his father's death, remained just and benevolent. And the male heir, produced so quickly by his wife, looked early on to be another compassionate king in the making. The castle did not crack or crumble. Every tide brought in new swarms of fish. The sons and daughters of the carpenters made tables and chairs even more marvelous than those their parents had produced. The sons and daughters of the bakers rose early every morning to produce more pies and cakes, more bread and muffins. There was, in general, peace, though robberies and contract disputes continued. Sons and daughters still occasionally ran off or lost their minds. Irritation, long harbored, still festered occasionally into murder. Nevertheless, overall, there was abundance and grace. There were marriages that lasted lifetimes. There were festivals and funerals. There were artisans and poets. Inventors produced mechanisms that shed clearer light, that uncomplainingly performed the drearier tasks, that captured and held music long thought to exist only as long as the players played and the singers sang. In the forest, the hares and pheasants paused occasionally with the same surprised interest at the sound of music and did not know or care whether the music emanated from living musicians or from musicians long dead. In town, children, all of whom had been born long after the old king and queen were laid side by side in their sarcophagi, discerned from among the music and the laughter that emanated from cafes, their parents calling them home. Some went willingly, some went grudgingly, but all of them, every child, returned home every night. Thank you. I should warn you that a lot of them are much darker and more fucked up than that. That was like that's like the little Maraschino cherry.
Right, right. No, it's
at
true.
At the end of the.
But it also, I mean, it allows space for.
No,
I mean,
I know. I'm really glad. I'm thrilled that you asked for it.
And the thing it makes me think of too is there's. If we kind of start at the ending points of stories and things, there's a beautiful Angela Carter story called The Courtship of Mr. Lion, which is like a retelling of Beauty and the Beast. She has a couple retellings, and one is kind of basically the story, but told in her language, which is incredibly beautiful, like yours is. And, but at the very end, there's a moment where the beast transforms into the man, and he looks kind of like a boxer and has a broken nose, and then he's walking with Beauty in kind of drifting petals, and there's sort of a twilight feeling. And I teach a fairy tale class, and we sort of talk about that as... I don't have the line memorized, but this feeling in the line of her trying to capture what is happily ever after. And I guess I felt like that's what you were doing in that story in a way, is like, what happily ever after becomes such a... trope that we kind of despise in a certain way because it's so unreal. So what is an actual, what does it look like? So yeah. I guess just to start with the story, since you just read it, what was it like to write a story that was not, that had this kind of hope in it?
Well, I felt that the collection should end with a fairy tale that obeys the physics of fairy tales in ways that the others don't quite. Right. I thought if some of the stories have relatively happy endings and some of them don't, the book should have a happy ending.
Yeah.
What would that look like?
Right.
To a cynical, old, self-battered creature like me? What would, how
they,
to...
They poured it.
How
they poured do, it. They hmm? Poured it. They already poured it.
Oh, no, I already drank it.
You already drank it.
Okay. Yeah. Right. No. You would not believe how much water I can suck up. And, you know, you never know if it's worked, even when it's published, no matter what people say, you always harbor doubts. But, I did want to try to do a story with a happy ending that didn't feel... It didn't, I guess I'd say, sort of trivialize happiness by portraying it as easily attained, easily maintained. I didn't want to write about a world in the free of murder and self-loathing and everything
human frailty and flaws that are in there, but just feel real.
But the children all go home at night.
Right, the children all go home at night.
Yeah, yeah.
They can hear their parents.
Good night, moon.
Music.
Good night, everybody. end of book.
Now, so you read fairy tales a lot as a child.
Well, my parents read to me. This is a perfect moment for me to say thank you, Dad. Happy birthday, Esther. My sister, Chris. My friends, Julie and Joe and Dale are all here. And I'm glad you're all here. But I don't know everybody's name. I do know their names, and I wouldn't be in this chair without you guys. Thank you.
So what tales do you remember as a kid?
It's funny. There's, I think, 10 stories you'd think I would know. I think there's 10, maybe 11. And there is no particular method to their selection. Mm. I just sort of would write one, and then I knew which one I wanted to write next. And it was only after I had the collection finished that I thought, why those?
You know,
why Snow White and not Cinderella?
Yeah.
Why Rumpelstiltskin and not Little Red Riding Hood? And I realized that they were simply... my particular favorites when I was a child, but why were they my favorites? I think this came out already in the lovely introduction. I was a inquisitive child, never irritating or troublesome in any way. But as noted, I learned eventually, but. We would get to happily ever after, and I'd go on.
Right. Yeah.
And he said, no, honey, that's the end. Uh-huh. No. What happens next? Happily ever after. Wow. So these are either the stories that elicited that particular question in me. Okay, Snow White gets kissed by the prince. She dumps the dwarfs.
Right. She does.
They go off to some castle that's just a shimmering golden silhouette on the hilltop. I did not find that satisfying.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then there were also the stories that sort of spurred me to ask, as an unirritating, troubling child, why would they do that?
Right.
You know, Rumpelstiltskin, the miller's daughter, is forced to spin 3 rooms full of straw into gold, and if she doesn't, the king will have her executed. Mm. Rumpelstiltskin helps out. She pulls it off, and she marries the king. Why would she do that? In Jack and the Beanstalk.
And I think you do, by the way, supply good reasoning. Like,
well, that's part of the point.
Exactly. Yeah. I think you built
swan
around that. Yeah.
Or why would they do that?
Right.
They put it on the cover. But it's about why, it's trying to account for some of the motives that were so mysterious to me as a child.
And fairy tales are kind of, they're always empty of motives, right? People just do things, the characters have no internal life, so they're just kind of, you know, in a grim story, you just get this very spare little nugget of tale. And so it's so fun to go in and see. And in that way, it reminded me a little of Anne Sexton, who has this great book, Transformations.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Which is
book.
Incredible. Yeah. And she's also very funny and has these moments where she'll question things, but I think you do that as well. And you also do something in your own way that I think is really wonderful that she kind of has in her way, which is to give the villains their due, you know, like to allow the, because Rumpelstiltskin is kind of villainized. There's other characters, there's a bit of like a spoiler alert effect because some of these stories work really well because you don't know right away which story he's referencing till a few pages in, so I don't wanna tell those. In fact, there was one, the crazy old lady one that was published under the title of the story it's referencing, and then you changed the title back, right?
Oh.
It says, like, previously published as, and I'm not going to say what it is. Because it's so wonderful to find out who this crazy old lady is, which I won't say.
She's a house made of candy.
Oh, no!
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm all for spoilers. I like a spoiler. So.
It's so fun when you're like, she's asked me to candy, it's her.
But it's true, you don't get it.
You don't, first. And so there's like this wonderful delay. But what about, do the villains go in that? Was there a feeling of like this good and evil of fairy tales is too easily split?
Yeah, or too under-examined. Mm. I have long felt that part of a writer's job is, it's sort of like this. You are the court-appointed attorney, and your client is guilty. Mm-hmm. You know your client is guilty. Mm-hmm. Your client is obviously guilty. Mm-hmm. And your job as the writer, vis-a-vis your characters, the evil stepmother, Rumpelstiltskin, the witch in Hansel and Gretel, is to get the person off, to get your client off, but you don't get a not guilty verdict by obfuscating and trumping up false evidence. You only get a non-guilty verdict if you can convince the jury about why he committed or she committed the crime in the first place.
So reader is jury.
Yeah.
Okay.
If the jury can be thoroughly led to understand why this person had to do what this person did, you've done your job.
Yeah. And in fact, with
how this person explained him or herself to him or her.
Yeah.
I hate the pronouns. I don't have the pronouns to drag. We need like 5 minutes of the night are all about something over him or her.
Right, I know.
Prisoner of political correctness.
But what's so nice is in like the Rumpelstiltskin one in particular, he's so sympathetic. It really is the Miller's daughter who ends. Well, all the rest of them end up feeling callous.
I don't feel unsympathetic to any of my characters, including these people. But in Mumpelstiltskin, it was sort of satisfying to make the Miller's daughter the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, I'll marry you, King. Yeah. Do I? Let's see. Yeah, I know you were going to have my head cut off if I couldn't do something impossible. But do I want to go back to the mill or do I want to be queen? Let me think about that.
Well, also you introduced Rumpelstiltskin as like a love interest potential in that he's a little bit in love with her. And I thought that was nice, too. You gave him a sexuality in that moment, too, which was nice because he really does not get that in the story, obviously.
No.
So that was, I thought, good.
No, I know. Love for everybody. You 400-year-old gnarly gnomes. Love for everybody in some form or another.
Just while we're on the Rumpelstiltskin story, there was the imagery in fairy tales is so rich, and I feel like you go into it, but then there are these moments where you kind of open it up into these little asides that are kind of beautiful gestures to this world that we don't know. So Rumpelstiltskin has an aunt, Farfalle, and that's kind of his contact point in the world. And there's just an aside of like, no one really knows where he lives. And even Aunt Farfalle lives in a tiny grotto that you have to swim 50 feet to get to. And it's just this beautiful little aside where suddenly her world opens up in that one half sentence. We suddenly know that somehow, you know, can he breathe underwater? You know, all these things about his gill situation in my mind. So I'm wondering too, like, is there something, you always have an incredible facility with language, but do you feel like there's something in the tales that allows for that level of invention or kind of sweetness in the language?
Well, you know, one of the tricky things about a short story, and these are short stories, albeit unorthodox ones. I don't usually write short stories, but I teach. I talk to people who write short stories all the time. I read short stories all the time. Henry James called the novel the great baggy monster. You know, it's the Queen Mary. You can put so much onto it. You can the Korean War and interstellar travel. Sure, sure. There's room in a novel for it. The short story, you know, is a dinghy. The short story has, you know, lost at sea. There's no room for anything extraneous in the short story at all, or it will just sink. And yet, if you keep it too compressed, you invoke a world in the short story that feels incomplete and claustrophobic, because in fact, people have parents, people have friends, people have pets, and you have to find a way. And this is why I don't ordinarily write short stories, because it's just too hard. You have to find a way to account for the larger world, just peripherally. You just have to drag the shadow of the larger world across the immediate action in a phrase, a sentence at most.
Nice. So in that moment with it's also allowing, it's allowing both her... There's such inventiveness in this tiny grotto that you have to swim to, but what it does is it gives her her life.
Yeah. And it gives him his life. It enlarges that smallish world for just a moment.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. And while we're on language, because when we were doing the sound check, I was quoting a line that actually I am going to read because it's just one line and it's so beautiful. This is in the Beauty and the Beast story about the father who lets Beauty go off to the Beast's castle after he's, she basically trades places. And because Michael, you said something I want to come back to because I thought it was so interesting. So this is a line. He'd sink with a certain sensuousness into the image of himself as an awful man, a heartless man, which would prove over time an easier man for him to be. And I was saying how the certain sensuousness is so incredible to me there, that feeling of that sinking into his own self-loathing has this kind of sensuousness, like there's a luxuriating in its quality. And so, and you said this thing that I thought was so interesting about the word and the word next to the word. So if you could talk about that.
It's one of those things, one of the great things about teaching is every now and then you find out, you hear yourself saying something, you think, oh, I guess that's true.
Right.
It seems to be true. The students are buying it. And we were talking, my students and I, about language and finding the word that's unexpected, but not so unexpected that it draws too much attention to itself, that it makes the sentence feel mannered or worked, and somebody speaking through me said, here's what you do. You stand on the obvious word. He sank with a certain ease. And then you look and see what word is immediately to its right or its left. And you use that word. You don't look three words down, because then you're going too far from the original meaning. Then you're straining. But just think about the word standing next to the first word that comes to mind.
But just to push on that a little bit, because I really, I love that, but it's different than simply a synonym, right? What you're talking about because ease and sensuousness are not, like, what is that left? Like, who are these words and what room are they in together?
Yeah, the thesaurus isn't going to help you here.
Right. So how do you guide yourself or a student to that left and right word? I mean, I think that's...
That's where you're on your own. That's where the professor can no longer help you.
Even for yourself, is it associative? Do you in that moment,
yeah.
Are you actually, do you think ease and then kind of move it's somewhere?
It's so automatic that, I mean, I meant it when I said I realized that there's a kind of system only when I tried to talk to other people about it.
Exactly.
How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's part of, like, it's unpacking a process that's essentially mysterious, but it's such, I really like it as a way of thinking about language, and there's so much love of language in all your work. Have you ever written poetry?
I tried.
Yeah?
I'm terrible at it.
Yeah.
And I really gave it a good shot because I love poetry.
Yeah.
Everything about it, including the fact that it's probably the only human pursuit more impractical than writing fiction.
Exactly. playwriting is up there.
If you're going to go in that way, why not go for broke? Why not, why not produce a slim volume of verse every few years? but, you know, I think it's sort of like this. It turns out that what I need, just the way I'm sort of mentally built, is I need to throw sort of glittery but not too glittery sentences at this sort of dull, dun-colored cinder block of narrative. Mm. If it's just as in poetry, it's just sort of the sentences twirling around on themselves, and that's what is so beautiful about it. And I can't do it. I have to be, you know, I have to be throwing pasta out of the wall. I can't just be throwing pasta into the cosmos. Okay.
I like that it became pasta.
Until
right?
A more tortured analogy comes along, that will be the prize winner for tonight.
But that makes me think of another thing too, which is this, because these are retellings of tales, but that you've worked with, like, it's such a duet, right? It's you and this other piece of writing, and you've done that with other pieces of writing too. And so, I mean, one question is, how is the fairy tale feel different than Mrs. Dalloway? You know, like, what are the different duets that you're having? But also, is that the same thing about the cinder block, that the cinder block is a bit in place when you have a story to play with? Like, there is, Rumpelstiltskin's there, and so it gives you a lot of, What's the draw to the retelling?
It varies. I mean, in many of my novels, I've had to first you have to build the cinder block, and then you start to not all of my books have used other books.
Exactly.
You know, I did look at Mrs. Dalloway, and I thought, I can make a fortune out of this.
I jest,
of course. But no, I did.
Everyone thinks when they look at Mrs. Dalloway. Money.
I did, of course, do a riff on Mrs. Dalloway in this book, The Hours. And, you know, this is a little bit of a stretch, but I realized that most of the adult books I love have certain fairy tale elements, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Clarissa Dalloway is the princess pining away for her lost love, unable to look at the prince kneeling at her feet because of that long ago kiss. Mm. One time, that girl.
Mm. So something
gone forever.
Yeah.
But she's up in the tower, looking down, waiting, like some princess.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice. I mean, one of the things it makes me think is it feels like there's a conversation that gets to happen then between you and this other. I mean, fairy tales are interesting because they're not authored, you know, except some of them are.
Well, basically,
Hans Christian Andersen
wrote those stories.
Yeah.
The Grimm brothers collected the stories.
Exactly.
They just wrote down
exactly
various stories, like 1,000 of them. And, yeah. And believe me, some of them are right. better than others.
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason Disney has never done the salad donkey.
That should be the quote of the evening.
You know, and then a surprising number of them, like Beauty and the Beast, Jack and the Beanstalk, come from neither of the two kind
right.
of official gods of fairy tale.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast is an old French story
exactly.
of uncertain origins.
Yeah. Or there's like one, yeah, there's various ones or what there's this one, The Steadfast Tin Soldier, that you redo really beautifully. And what was interesting to me too is that's from this Hans Christian Andersen story. And since that is more written, I felt like your story was more its own story, like the link was more tenuous.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus
yeah.
the Grimm ones, you can really recognize the Grimm story, but they're so spare because they're unauthored, essentially, that you can go in and you can build all this world around it. But I felt it was like Steadfast, comma, Tin becomes, stands next to. It's just like the language thing, right? It
yeah.
stands next to that story as opposed to being of a piece with, and so, Did you, like, what's your relationship to those stories versus the Grimm? Do you feel like you have a different readership
you know,
of those?
I'm sure that's how it came out.
Yeah.
But writing is more intuitive for me than that. I think
yeah.
I bet it's true for you, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I think most
yeah.
of us find that half the things we do, we don't know why we did it.
It just
seems right.
Yeah.
Certainly true of all of my versions of all the fairy tales, wherever they came from, are homages. I love these stories.
Yeah.
I'm trying to honor these stories. They are not in any way sort of, you know, wised up postmodern poo-poo-poo to this
yeah.
silly children's story
yeah. Yeah.
kind of things. They're,
yeah.
I'm just engaging them and
yeah.
trying to rework them without trying to replace them or dismiss them. And I found that some of the stories, like The Steadfast Tin Soldier, as you say, it's so powerfully written. Also, The Wild Swans, which is beautifully
yeah,
written.
Right.
Oh my God, oh my
yeah.
God. The king married a new wife and she gave the princes little cups of sand to play with. Hans Christian Andersen, where'd you come up with that one? That is good. I didn't, certainly in The Steadfast Tin Soldier, I didn't want to do toys in a playroom.
Yeah.
So where do you go from there?
Yeah, it's exciting because then you see, yeah, it both ways work really well, but I thought it was just neat to see them together. Or The Monkey's Paw was one I actually didn't know. So I read yours first and then went back and said, what's The Monkey's Paw? And
that's a bit of a cheat. It's not really a fairy. It's not technically a fairy tale. It's just one of the great
story.
Horror stories
yeah.
of all time.
Incredible.
Ackerley, I think. Yeah.
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 yeah. From late 1800s.
Yeah.
yeah.
No, and that was fun. It was, yeah, I sort of pieced it backwards on that one because yours
yeah.
was first, and then I could look and say, oh, you know, that was fun. I feel like the homage to the tales totally comes through. Are there any retellings that are favorites of yours? When you think of just, you know, the world of fairy tales and the kind of the film, and there's like a nice nod to, I felt the Cocteau movie in a moment in the Beast story when there's a wall with the candelabra.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not, the lights dim on their own. And so, you know, there's these incredible fairy tale retellings that you kind of join a canon. With this book. So are there favorites of yours?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Amy Carter and Anne Sexton, who
yeah,
have both
yeah.
been there before me and
so
produced
great.
Amazing, brilliant retellings of fairy tales. One, Angela Carter wrote stories.
Yeah.
Sexton wrote poems, and I actually sort of paused over, like, really? You're going to stand next to those two girls? But then I thought,
why not?
Yeah. It's not like we're going to stop writing love stories because of Anna Karenina.
Right, exactly.
We're a little daunted since Anna Karenina. I love the Cocteau movie.
Yeah.
Though at the end, I don't know how many of you have seen it, the Beast, when he turns back into the prince, is played by Cocteau's boyfriend at the time.
Yeah.
And let me just say that as a gay man, the sight of that prince made me rethink gay bashing. He's awful.
Right, he's sort of all done up.
And poofy and lacy and you know, blonde and narcissistic and blonde and
he's horrible. And I think there's
Forgive me, if that smacked of homophobia, I hope every gay person and straight person in the room will forgive me. But he's an awful. The Beast is so preferable.
Yeah.
To that terrible. To that terrible sort of part, you know, baby cake of a prince, there's a famous, I think, true story when Garbo went to see the movie as they were leaving. She said, "Give me back my beast."
Totally. Into Cocteau's ear, right?
Some story. And one of that we don't want. I'm not going to do the spoiler on my Beauty and the Beast,
but
when I did my Beauty and the Beast, I got to thinking, have you ever dated a beast? You know, it's all fine to romanticize, you know, to go all Stanley Kowalski with the beast, but really,
right?
You know,
right.
Think twice about idealizing that guy. Beauty.
There's so much psychological play and depth, I think, in how you interpret the characters in that way. I think that's a great point. Now, I think we're right at audience
time. I would love to talk to anybody, everybody. This is my favorite part, because look at you. You could be doing anything tonight.
Yeah.
Think what's on television. And you're here. Oh, wow, that's a sacrifice. I think there was a hand over here.
I can't remember who said it, but I heard something once that I thought was brilliant, which is whether a story has a happy ending or a sad ending depends on where you end it.
Mm.
And so I'm just wondering, since you had so many problems with fairy tale endings, how you decided where to end your stories?
That's a really good question. I'm going to take a crack at it, and I'd like you to get in on this too. This is not just me up here.
Yeah.
I just want to say that endings are really hard. Someday I want to do a series of writing seminars. The title will be "Beats the Hell Out of Me." And each week we will tackle another unanswerable question, and our opening session will be endings, any story starts when those ambitious fish sort of walked out of the water, and probably before then, and every story doesn't really end until the sun supernovas and destroys the solar system, and possibly after that. So the question is not where to begin or where to end, but where to enter and where to leave a story too vast for anyone, for everyone to tell. And the trick is not where to end it, it's where to leave it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's trying to find the point at which the stories, if this makes any sense, mystery is simultaneously solved and deepened.
Nice.
You know, and this story is the end of this story and the beginning of the next story. Mm. Would you talk about that a little bit?
But that's really
tired
nice.
I'm hearing myself.
I feel like it is intuitive, like you were saying, in terms of actually knowing, and probably depends on how the writer's feeling on a particular day. But I do think where you end something, you play your hand. The writer shows her hand, really, because there's, in a good way, there is a moral, like if the ending is a moral in a fairy tale, there's always a moral line drawn at the point of ending. But I don't mean it in the fairy tale moral way, just in that a value system is revealed in some way, and that kind of ripples back through the rest of the story. So, but you can't know that when you end it, because then it would freeze me up, probably freeze me up tomorrow when I'm trying to end something. But that it's more of a felt thing. Or sometimes I think of it as a note. You find yourself feeling a note, a bass note, or maybe it's a high note, and that there's infinite options.
Can I just tell you one of the best endings of all time? Mm. It's a Beryl Bainbridge novel called 1939. Mm. It's a little like the Garden of the Finzi Continis. Mm. It is this very aristocratic Jewish family in Germany who can't imagine that anything bad could happen to them, and they are finally arrested and put on a train. And the last line is, "It's so crowded and uncomfortable in here. I know we can't be going very far."
Right, and it's exactly.
I know.
Yours was a gun, mine was a knife. Right. Yeah.
Are you in communication with these people who take a camera and they go to just the right place and take a picture, and fairies appear in their pictures?
Oh. No, but if you know how to reach them, I would love to talk to them. No, I'm not. But I can tell you that I found that anything you write, anything you invent, inevitably matches somebody's story out there. The novel that Poe was writing a year ago before this book, it's called The Snow Queen, and it involves a man, a very secular, no nonsense, quote unquote, kind of guy who is walking across Central Park and looks up and has a vision, sees a light in the sky, and as he looks at it, understands that the light is looking at him as well. And I can't tell you. Well, not hundreds, but I'd heard from a number of people, clearly rational people, whatever I mean, but you know what I mean, who said, "I saw that light."
Wow.
And I believe them. I just don't happen to have seen it. But it's almost like you can't make anything up that hasn't happened to somebody.
Yeah.
I'm going to put fairies in the next one just to see what who I hear from.
You've both mentioned teaching, and you mentioned there's some things that the teacher can't help you with. I was wondering, what's your goal or mission when you take on a class or undertake teaching writers? What's an achievable goal? What do you feel is essential?
Amy, do you teach?
I do.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
You start.
Sure. This is what I feel, is that the core is mysterious and intuitive, but it's mucked up by obstacles and rules that everyone has absorbed about writing, about a creative process, about ways to get to something, about all of that. So I think as a teacher, you can clear away a lot of obstacles. And in doing that, the line to that intuitive core gets quicker or smoothed out. And again, I've seen students trust that process more, and the language shifts and changes. So although there's craft stuff you can teach, and I do teach that, and I find it interesting, the real interest to me is kind of how do we clear that other stuff away?
I hope that if I've done my job at the end of the semester, 24 students walk out of each of my two classes as better readers, as more open, more intuitive, more clued in, more aware of how language works. Mm. If some of them, a few of them, actually turn out to be writers, you know, blessings on them, God help them. But I never discourage a student. I don't offer false encouragement, but I don't need them to be writers. I want them to try to find their own voice. Mm-hmm. I want them to experience the ways in which you actually make more sense to yourself by writing as truthfully as you can about other people. You kind of explain yourself to yourself in a, to a certain degree. I want that for them.
Yeah.
Hi, this is an honor. I am such a huge fan of both of yours. Michael, apart from, we went to the same high school, so I'm wondering if any of our high school teachers affected you, but did in particular Maria Tatar or Italo Calvino play any part in your thought processes?
Mm. I'm sorry, Calvino and who else?
Maria Tatar.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, because they are both among, for me, the relatively small body of writers who you'd have to call experimental, but are not dull. You know, who are actually writing about life in an unorthodox way, because that's the best way to tell the story they want to tell. I feel like if somebody says, "Want to read this novel? It's experimental." It's like, get it away. But no, those two writers and a couple others, Ben Marcus. There are a few writers who are really, really, really questioning storytelling and the ways in which stories are told, who I find enlivening and inspiring, and I bow down to them.
If we have no more questions, we'll invite everyone to join us in the
lobby. Thank you
for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.